Welcome to 1001 Albums. Today we'll be discussing Louis Prima, The Wildest, with Louis Prima Jr.
And just a gigolo, and everywhere I go, the people know the part I'm playing. Paid for every dance, selling his romance. Oh, the scene. There will come a day, and youth will pass away. What will they say about me? When the end comes, I know they'll say just a gigolo. Life goes on without me.
Welcome to 1001 Albums, Louis Prima Jr. How are you doing?
I am doing fantastic. Thanks for having me.
You are more than welcome. Whereabouts in the world are you?
Right now, I am in New Orleans, Louisiana. I normally would be coming to you from Las Vegas, but my son just moved down here to join the fire department, and I am actually moving back to New Orleans within the next week. I have to fly back home and then finish packing my house and load it up and drive. So I'm coming to you from New Orleans, the Big Easy.
Wow, fantastic. And that's interesting because obviously we're here to talk about your father's album, The Wildest, and he was...
Yes.
He was from New Orleans and moved to Las Vegas. So it's quite, that's not a coincidence, I take it.
No, not at all. I grew up in New Orleans and in Las Vegas, both. I do call New Orleans home because it, you know, and from here, the people are great. I miss this place. And it was my father's home. So there's a lot of respect for him and for music and that type of culture down here. So I'm excited to be coming back home. And, you know, my father moved to Vegas. I mean, he originally got his start up in New York and did a lot of his early recordings in Chicago. And of course, with his success in New York, it ended up Hollywood. And then he moved to Vegas kind of with the rest of the entertainment crowd back in the early 50s when the heyday of Vegas started.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And he was, you know, it's been a real pleasure preparing for today because I've just thrown myself into Louis Prima world, and it's a fantastic world to be in. I'll tell you that.
It's, you know, you don't get much better in the entertainment world than him. You know, it's 50 years of a career that changed course a dozen times and maintained, success in whatever he tried. And his music continues on today, and it, there's not a lot of artists that you can, you know, count on one hand that have that distinction.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the things I think is amazing is that you're right. He was able to move with the times and change, but yet paradoxically always remained 100% him, and his attitude just comes through in everything he's doing, which is, I can't understand how he did that. And I don't really, I can't think of any other artist that did.
No, not a, and you know, it's primarily his style and his music and his upbringing. You know, those early days in New Orleans, you know, back in the 1910, 1920s, the street music was all about happy and feeling good. And I've always said, you know, when I'm touring around, the music is supposed to be, you know, music dating back to the caveman, or to let you escape and to provide happiness and joy. And my father's music is the core of that happiness and joy, to where no matter what style he was doing, you know, small combos, big band, moving into rock and roll, the 70s and things, no matter what he did, the music he performed and played and wrote exuded happiness and joy. And it really does, no matter what it was, make you tap your foot and want to dance. And that's what music is supposed to do to us. You know, we're not supposed to, you know, be singing about depressing things. And you know, sure, there's the song about heartbreak, but it's, you know, it's in its core, it's supposed to uplift you and make you happy.
Absolutely. And I've really enjoyed as well going back and watching the old performances and the old TV shows he did. And there's always just you can just tell what a great entertainer he was. There's always this amazing, you know, even as you say, even in the quieter moments, there's just this devilish smile on his face. And you know that, like, and when he was working with Keeley Smith, who's you know, the featured sort of vocalist on this album, they had this wonderful juxtaposition between them, because he's just this over exuberant performer and it's like just weird, like deadpan style. But and you know, it's one of those things that, like, when like in a film, when you get the outtakes and you get like the people, you know, when they're cracking up, that's often the funniest thing, I think. And that's why it's so, it's such a joyous thing to watch them, because you always see her, he's like desperate to sort of make her laugh, and she's sort of, you know, you can see her start corpsing and things, and that is part of it. You know, it's, music is great, and yeah, we like Radiohead and these albums that can, you know, these artists that make dark, strange music like Joy Division, right. But there's just something so special about, you know, just the joy, like you said, and especially that relationship of the band that he had around this time, all those different characters together, it just makes for such an incredible alchemy.
Nobody cares for me. I'm so sad and lonely.
Sad and lonely. Want some sweet mama? Come take a chance with me, 'cause I ain't so bad.
It does, and he, you know, he did have the unique ability to take his supporting cast of characters, no matter who they were, and bring out the best in them. You know, he demanded performance. He demanded, you know, the top musicianship, and he demanded that they, you know, he commanded that they all enjoy themselves and have a good time. And, you know, playing off his lead, you know, there aren't too many people. I mean, you can go to, you know, George Burns and go, there hadn't been a lot of people that were not afraid to be self-deprecating to the benefit of everybody around them for the sake of the laugh or the smile. And he was, you know, he was very willing to step back and let the other people be stars and let them shine in whatever their positive point was. And, you know, that's another piece of brilliance around him. But he did, you know, he did surround himself with the best, and you know, it's on every single album he does. Is not, you know, that it's hard to find a weak album or weak moments.
And I that's a really good point I was going to say about that, the fact that, and it happens on this album as well, on The Wildest, that he'll say, come on Sam, like that, and you know, and it's great, because you know, you don't get that with, you know, Sinatra doesn't say, come on, you know, to the guitar player. But in this instance, he is, you just get, well, that's one of the things when listen to this album, and I've been kind of going on this journey through these albums, and a lot of the 1950s albums, you find that it's either, you know, very early rock and roll, or, you know, quite hard jazz like bebop, and you know, whether you've got, you know, Duke Ellington and you know, Miles Davis, early Miles Davis and things like that.
Right.
And it's very dry and it's great music, but you know, you've got to strap yourself in, you know, especially bebop, it's hard. Whereas then you get something like this and it's just such a breath of fresh air. You've still got the great playing. You've still got the appreciation of this fantastic playing. But
yes,
one of the things I really love about the album is the fact that it feels like a live recording. I know it's not, you know, it is done. It's not like a live recording, like, you know,
right,
like James Brown at the Apollo or something. It's in sort of effectively a studio album, effectively. Although it was filmed in the actual lounge where they played, though. Is that right?
Yes. And, you know, he did that on a lot of his albums. I mean, it wasn't until probably the last couple of albums in the 70s where the studio album became sounding like a studio album. And I think that's a adverse effect of technology, because you see that even in albums today, artists that should sound amazing, that just sounds dry because of the studio. But he had the unique ability, and you can go through, you know, a lot of his albums, and you know, you can pull up King of Clubs, which was in the 60s, and my mother was singing with him. And that, to me, is one of the greatest live performances and live albums ever to find. And you play it next to The Wildest, and you do get that same live feel. And mostly it was the recording style. He carried over the recording style, you know, from the 30s and the 40s, where you just hung a couple microphones in the room and played. Mm. And, you know, there's footage of them in, you know, in Capitol Records recording albums where you know, there's two main mics hanging in the room and the band is playing live, and there was no tracking or no, you know, no overdubbing. And then there was a third mic hanging in the room that the, you know, my father would sing into. And if it was your time to solo, you had to run up on it and solo into it. And it's funny because you can hear that on the early albums, like in the 30s, when the guitar player is trying to solo, you can hear him just, you know, having a hard time getting close enough to the mic. but by doing that, I mean, it allowed the band to play together as a whole, to play off each other. And, you know, some of the footage, like when he was recording Jungle Book, the video footage of him recording that, you know, they're dancing around and having a good time in the studio. And it really does. I mean, I find it hard to find bands that can do that. Other than like an AC/DC or somebody like that, that just sounds live no matter what they're doing. And my father sounded live no matter what he was doing.
In the meantime, let me tell you that I love you.
Buonasera, senorina, kiss me goodnight. Buonasera, senorina, kiss me goodnight. But the red do that to rip, but bona body boat, but do the battle boat. Buonasera, senorina, buonasera. It is time to say goodnight to Napoli. Though it's hard for us to whisper, buonasera, with that old moon above the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's great. I think there are a number of bands that, you know, that are great live and historically been great live bands, but then they just lose it as soon as they get into the studio. Something happens.
Absolutely.
I think that you've even, like, my other podcast I do is the Oasis podcast about the British band Oasis.
Oasis, yes.
Yeah, and and that was the problem they had. When they first went in to record their debut album, they were just this great, you know, band out playing the nightclubs and these little toilet gig venues, and then they're suddenly in this massive recording studio with microphones everywhere, and you know, just these young lads from Manchester, they couldn't cope with it, and they had to scrap their album and start all over again. And so I think that's great that, I suppose, not only did he have, you know, coming in to record something like The Wildest, this isn't like a 19-year-old coming in on his 17th gig,
right?
This is someone that's had, you know, all those hard yards and years of experience of being in front of crowds, and that just really jumps out of the record at you.
Absolutely, it does. And it, you know, and it's a testament to some of the, you know, it's a testament to bands that are out there grinding and grinding and grinding, and then they get the chance and get to go in the studio. And I think, you know, I think time spent learning your craft, I think Dave Grohl said it, go get a band and get in your garage and suck for a little while and get out there on the road and play that first gig that nobody shows up and just grind until you try to make it. It's not unlike a sport, you know, how many baseball players go from high school to the pros? You know, how many, you've got to sow your oats. And it did benefit him because he was every bit the pro on stage and, you know, behind the mic in the studio. He knew what he was doing, that's for sure.
Yeah. I think that the best example I can think of that from a UK perspective is the Beatles. You know, the Beatles had the time in Hamburg, didn't they, where they were just playing like hours and hours and hours of playing. And so hence that's where McCartney's dipping into his old, you know, his old sort of dad's having been a band, you know, jazz player, sort of, you know, right. So he knew like Mr. Moonlight and all those old sort of songs, and so hence they're just, you know, and they're, so they're playing Ray Charles, they're playing that, and it's that combination of all that stuff, just having to play for hours to entertain these, you know, these people in these nightclubs. And so therefore when they then come into the studio, it's like, well, of course they're going to play with these different jazz chords and different things, and that's where then the later, you know, amazing recording comes from, because they've had those hours, they've had those 10,000 hours, didn't they?
They put in the time, absolutely.
Any tracks on the album, because I know you now are you perform as well, don't you? Obviously, we're in bloody lockdown at the moment, but you are keeping the legacy alive, aren't you? Out performing, performing your father's music. So, do you want to just tell us about that?
Well, I've been doing music, you know, on and off my whole life. I, you know, did my time for 10 years in a touring rock band in the States, and you know, jumped gears into a professional job, so to speak, while I raised my children. And then I, you know, wanted to get back into music because I truly just miss the stage. I love being on stage. I think I'm cursed with the same desires as my father, as far as, you know, having a mic in my hand and making people happy. And so I used my father's music as an opportunity to get back on stage and also to, you know, continue his legacy. I feel that his music style, as you touched on earlier, no matter what time frame or what music you're doing, if as long as you kind of stick to that prima vibe and that prima style, that it's going to be successful. So, you know, I started off about 2006 putting the band together, and we hit our stride, and I found all my mostly permanent members in 2010. We played Jazz Fest in New Orleans, and kind of the rest is just plowed us into a dead stop here during the unfortunate coronavirus.
Sure.
But it's been amazing. You know, we started doing my father's music. Our second album, our record label is Warrior Records on Universal Music Distribution. And our first album, Return to the Wildest, actually, touched on, you know, some of my father's hits that I think are neat. And then as we moved into our second album, the second album was about 70% original material. We covered Adam Ant's Goody Two Shoes, and I got to do a duet with my father at Capitol Records, thanks to them. And we just finished recording our third album, which is all original, and unfortunately that's on hold due to the coronavirus, and as soon as we can, you know, start booking dates again. But it's been a pleasure. My father's fan base is so diverse. There's really no age group specific, no ethnicity. It's kind of a hodgepodge of everybody when we play. And it's amazing to see that his legacy touched so many people that they did pass it down to younger generations. Mm. And younger generations are finding it themselves. You know, my sax player, when he joined the band, you know, was about 15, 20 years younger than me. He was just a kid when I hired him. And, you know, he grew up listening to my father for no other thing, but that was his choice.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's really neat, you know, and we have had an opportunity to come across the water and play. I got to play in Sicily and in Italy, and we've done a few gigs in Europe. I played Swindon, we played the Swansea Jazz Festival, we played up in Weston-super-Mare and things, and we actually had quite a few dates this year in Europe that got canceled out, but I'm looking forward to getting back on the road and continue spreading the magic, because I do feel that the band and I channel what my father did. Everybody in my band is a star and gets to shine during the shows, and we all truly enjoy doing his music as well as, you know, other music in his style. And it's, you know, like I said, it's just neat that so many people still enjoy it and that younger generations enjoy it. It just kind of goes to the timelessness of this album. And it just, I've always said a good song is a good song and will transcend everything, and everybody can enjoy it. And I think my father took that a step further. To be a good act is a good act, you know.
With the heartbreak open, so much you can't hide. I put on a little makeup, make sure you get your good side. If the words unspoken get stuck in your throat, send a dredge token, write it on a pound note.
And I mean, when you look at when you're putting your set list together, I mean, are you that must be very difficult, say, when there's 50 years of recordings and you know, amazing live performances to pick from. I mean, that must be very tough.
It's very tough. But one of the things, my father never really worked with a set list. He knew what he was going to start with. He knew what he was going to finish with. And everything in between was based on the crowd. And we do that as well. I mean, we have a basic idea. Like, we know we want to hit on, you know, some of the things from our album. You know, we have to, we know that you have to play Gigolo, you have to play certain things. But we base the rest on the crowd. If it's a crowd that's really digging the Prima stuff, I'll just start calling out songs. And, you know, you kind of get you do enough dates and enough shows, you get a sense of, do they want older Prima? Do they want newer Prima? What do they want, you know? Just based off their applause and things. And, you know, we always hit a little section in the middle of the show where it's a medley of just whatever we feel like playing. That could be Prima, it could be, you know, Chicago, it could be the Rolling Stones. It doesn't matter. We're going to play and have a good time. But there's, I mean... I know the band doesn't like me in the sense that we, you know, we have 70, 80, 90 songs sitting in a repertoire that I can call at any moment, so they better know it.
That's brilliant. But that's how he did it, right? I was watching a documentary earlier, and that's how he did it, that they said that same opening song, always end with When the Saints Go Marching In, but in between, he would just call it. And well, even I saw in the documentary that he would even, the lighting guy at the start, okay, what do you want to do? He'd say,
yes.
You know, no, you follow me. I'll show you what to do. And just as the thing's going on, he'd be pointing, yep. So to not only be the singer, not only be the lead trumpet player, not only be the MC, but he's also directing the lighting. He's making up the set list as he goes. It's amazing, really, that he did all that.
He knew what crowds wanted, you know, and it's tough to, in that sense, follow in that footstep, so to speak, and, you know, match what he did. Because it was, you know, I was fortunate that I do have vivid memories of seeing him perform. And everywhere from theaters to small nightclubs, he just knew, he knew what to do. He knew where to stand. He knew how to stand. And if things weren't working, he would stop dead in the middle of a song and change directions. And, you know, and it, other artists, you know, even to Frank Sinatra, would come and sit in the crowd and study how he did it, because it was magical. It was the ultimate orchestration. It's like Mickey Mouse and Fantasia standing up on the mountain directing the sea. It's just, that's how he did it, you know.
Yeah.
And it was magical to watch. It was magical to be in the crowd. I'm sure, you know, and you can hear the crowds on the live albums. They just loved everything he did. You know?
He's there eating out of the palm of his hand all the way through. It is amazing.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to touch upon, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, but yeah, it's incredible that he had this whole huge career all the way back from like the 1920s even. And yeah, even in the sort of the twilight end of his career, he has his biggest ever success, which is he is the Jungle Book. He's Cousin Louie. He's the I Want to Be Like You, which is such an incredible, iconic song. And yeah, that's him.
Now I'm the king of the swingers, the jungle VIP. I've reached the top and had to stop, and that's what's bothering me. I want to be a man cub, and stroll right into town and be just like the other men. I'm tired of monkeying around. Ooh, I want to be like you. I want to walk like you, talk like you too. You see, it's true, an ape like me can learn to.
You know, what an amazing thing to have that, like, as a sort of, I know it wasn't the end of his career, he carried on with another, you know, right up until he got ill, but, you know, It's amazing, really. I mean, was that as a kid growing up, did you know, like, did you used to watch The Jungle Book and be like, that's my dad? Or...
Well, it's funny that, you know, you try to pretend like you have these memories from, you know, when you're two or three and things. And I do have a vivid memory, and I don't know how old I was, three or four maybe. And I remember the movie theater, it was in Las Vegas, and it was called the Centorama. It had a big giant dome with these prism angles on the top of it and reflected light everywhere, and they did the premiere for Jungle Book there, and I do remember sitting watching him when he came on the screen. I remember looking and then looking up at my dad and looking at the screen and wondering, how's he doing that, you know? Because as a little kid you didn't know. But you know, I always say this song is the one song of everything my father did. It's the one song everybody knows. If I'm traveling around, you know, you do get a lot of people that go, I don't know who Louis Prima is. And you can start listing songs from movies, from soundtracks, from commercials, and they'll kind of go, yeah, I kind of know that. And, you know, you can bring up Brian Setzer and Jump, Jive, and Whale, or David Lee Roth and Just a Gigolo, but absolutely every person knows Jungle Book.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are or where you're from. And, you know, even growing up, the kids knew that was my dad, you know, on that screen. And it's, you know, it's iconic that, and it was actually the Sherman Brothers that wrote the song for the cartoon that told Walt Disney about my father. They said, they got this guy, he's playing the lounges in Vegas, and you got to go see him, and let's, you know, get him on the screen. And they went and saw him, and the rest is history. And it was just a brilliant pairing. And you know, back then they drew the cartoon around the person.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of characteristics in that orangutan to my father, and you know, so you can almost see him when you're watching it.
Yeah, when he leans back and he puts his arm out, it's like, yep, that's him. That's him all over.
And you know, he ended up with a great relationship with Disney. He re-recorded the soundtrack to Mary Poppins.
Mm-hmm.
He did Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious in Italian, which was cool. He did an album in support of the cartoon Robin Hood with the little fox.
Hi there. Aren't you going to speak to me? I'm waiting to hear you say hi. That's better. You know who this is, don't you? This is King Louie. Ooh, 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 ooh. You remember me from Jungle Book? I thought you would. But let me ask you this. Did you know that Robin Hood and I were friends long, long ago? Honest, I knew Rob almost as well as I know you. And you know what pals you and I have been ever since the movie Jungle Book. Well, let me tell you a secret that no one knows except you and me. King Louie and Robin Hood were friends long ago. If you believe in make-believe, you'll find that this is so. They used to hang around together like a set of twins. That's the way that they became the very best of friends.
And he was supposed to be the lead in The Rescuers when he got sick. And there's actually a couple of songs that you can find on the internet, test recordings of songs. There's some actual cells drawn of his character, and they held on to the movie for, you know, about a year before they recast it and put The Rescuers out the way we know it. But yeah, Disney, and I think that was an important piece for my father jumping into, you know, the rock and roll movement of the mid-60s and through the 70s in maintaining his popularity and also giving him the opportunity to change gears again and maintain that popularity.
Mm. No, absolutely. And like you said, the Sherman Brothers wrote that song, but it's a Louis Prima song. Like, you know, all of the, like, the,
absolutely,
you know what I mean? All the scat singing he's doing and everything, like the back and forth with it. It's, you know, you can just tell he brings so much personality to that song. That's not like the song's written, sit down and do it. That is him all over. It's brilliant.
That's 100% him. I believe the Sherman Brothers wrote that song after seeing him and deciding that this could be a character in the movie, just because it is so much him. You know, and the whole band is back there screaming as the little monkeys and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a classic Prima tune.
Yeah. You know? No, absolutely. Great. Well, looking back at The Wildest, is there any other tracks that particularly stick out for you?
You know, it's the whole album is great, you know, and I love Nothing's Too Good for My Baby. I really think of all the duets that him and Keeley did, that one kind of shines for me. I think it's just perfectly kitschy and cute, and they played well off each other. Come on, Oh Marie. Oh Marie is funny because Oh Marie was a Italian folk song that was uncopywritten, and my father saw that and copywrote it and recorded it, and ended up just being a huge hit. I mean, that's a song. We get a lot of requests for that song when we play.
Oh Marie,
oh Marie,
oh Marie,
oh Marie,
in your arms I'm longing to be.
Longing to be.
Baby.
Baby.
Tell me you love me.
Tell me you love me.
Kiss me once while the stars shine above me.
Shine above me.
Hey, hey, Marie.
Hey, Marie.
Oh, Marie.
Oh, Marie.
In your arms I'm longing to be.
Longing to be.
Oh, baby.
Oh, baby.
Tell me you love me.
Tell me you love me.
Hey, Marie.
Hey, Marie.
Hey, Sammy. Come here, boy. Hey, Marie.
And I'm kind of near and dear to want to say that because I got to do that song in Sicily, and it's one of the few times I got overly emotional on stage, just because it was, you know, I'm standing there under the Mediterranean, you know, on the Mediterranean Sea underneath a full moon. It was kind of neat. But my favorite song probably it was recorded during these sessions, but didn't come out till the re-release. They put it on as a, you know, on a re-release of The Wildest. You can find it on the, you know, the Capitol Collector series and things like that. But 5 months, 2 weeks, 2 days. I love that song. We throw that in the set as many times as we can. I just kind of think that's one of the funnest songs that he did.
5 months, 2 weeks, 2 days. My loving baby's been gone. 5 months, 2 weeks, 2 days. My loving baby's been gone. If you see my baby, please send her home for me. Hurry, oh home, baby. 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 Hurry, oh home, baby.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. I sort of, you know, did a bit of a journey. I found, you know, sort of just in the history of it, you sort of hear, okay, rock and roll starts with Elvis and Little Richard. Okay, fine. But then it's like, hold on a minute. What was this guy doing? Like, you know, this is rock and roll, man. This is rock and roll. This is more rock and roll than Elvis's first album. You know, when even going back to the earlier stuff. And
absolutely.
You know, you've got those pounding drums and the wailing sax, and you know, this makes Bill Haley look very old fashioned and boring when you get this. So, you know, forget that. You know, rock and roll starts with Elvis. Rock and roll starts a lot before that.
He does get mention of that quite a bit, even from popular artists. You know, that I think everybody acknowledges that he is one of the first founders of rock and roll. I mean, when you listen to Oh Marie, when they get into the crux to that solo and the drum, you know, Bobby Morris is hitting them drums harder than just about anybody, or like the end of I'll Be Glad When You're Dead, the same thing. They're just hitting on they are truly hitting on 11. And it's a freight train coming at you, and that is rock and roll. That is just a reckless abandon that started rock and roll. And, you know, he did that. He was doing that back in the 30s, you know, with his little jazz combo. You can listen to some of them albums. And, you know, and he continued it up through the end of his career, you know, before he got sick, that just it was always hard driving and fun, and it really makes you, there's moments where you want to jump out of your seat, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. As I say, I've been listening to it around the house, and, you know, even I've got kids, and my kids are just, you just see it, you just can't not dance around to it. I think it was Jump Jive and Whale was a big hit. Was it Brian Setzer about 20 years ago?
Yes.
And that, I think that must have had a, you know, that was a big resurgence. I didn't even know it was a Louis Prima original. I didn't put the two and two together until a few years ago. And I've got a collection, I think, on Blue Note, a compilation that's got a couple of Louis Prima songs and that sort of early, you know, pre-rock and roll kind of thing.
Right.
And it's like, it's, yeah, it is just... Anyway,
he just had a unique ability to do that to a song. I mean, he did that, you know, just a Gigolo is a sad song,
yeah,
about a French airman coming home from war. And look at what he did with this song.
Yeah.
You know? And there's an album, I think it's Prima Show in the Casbah, that it's a live album that my father starts the show with the song Solitude. And Solitude has got to be one of the most depressing, heart-wrenching songs that you can listen to. And my father does it, you know, it starts off just piano and him, piano drums and him on the trumpet just noodling away. This song, it's this freight train of people jumping around and screaming and hollering and yelling. I always think that song is the epitome of what he did with all songs.
Yeah,
he took music and had the unique ability to laugh at it.
Yes,
and make
yeah.
it fun. You
yeah.
know.
I think that really comes across. It comes across on the album, which is an amazing, you know, thing to be able to do that on a record.
Right.
But then going back and watching the footage of it, and you can just see, like I said earlier, he's got this twinkle in his eyes, and you know, and the way he's kind of just playing with the rest of the band, and he is. It's you're taking he's laughing at music. He's, you know, it's sort of. There's nothing. He's not taking it seriously. He's able to do it, but also be, you know, to have that kind of, you know, that knowing grin about it the whole time. And yeah, no,
absolutely,
it's a real talent. Looking back at so I don't know if did you know that this is, you know, the album The Wildest was in this book, this 1001 Albums You Must Hear book.
Yes, I did. I'm familiar with the book. I'm quite a bit of an audiophile with a huge eclectic taste in music, and where I don't, kind of like my father says, I read a little bit, but not enough to hurt me none. I'm not big on reading, but I'm familiar with the book. It's come across me several times throughout you know, the past decade or so, or however long it's been out there, and touched on for more reasons than just this album, just because it's, you know, you bring it up in reference to things you like and material that's out there. And I think it is neat that he's included here, because one of the unfortunate things in my father's career is he just never got respect on the musician side of it. You know, he's only got one Grammy, and that's for Old Black Magic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got one official gold album, which was the Jungle Book soundtrack. He put out, I mean, wow. I mean, there's 100 albums at least worth of material out there. And, you know, he's not considered for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We've been trying for years and years and years and years. It took us till 2010 to get him a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
What?
Yeah. So it's, you know, and it's, you know, if you mention him to jazz purists, they scoff at him mostly because he was just so fun on stage and they don't want to be associated with joking around. But every single one of them will play Just a Gigolo. Every single one of them will play Jump, Jive, and Wail. Mm. It's like, you know, give him the credit where it's due. And it's nice when things like this do come out and he is included because he, you know, people don't realize that he was a genius when it came to music and what to do with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I play with people, I've played with some of the most brilliant musicians I know, and you know, you get to parts and songs and they stop you and go, "That I don't understand this chord change. It shouldn't go that way." And you got to tell them it may not, in theory, go that way, but it went that way for my father, and listen to it. It's brilliant. So leave it there. He was brilliant in what he did. Musically, he was brilliant in what he did. Showmanship. And an album like this just shows it off, you know?
Is there any other albums of his that you think also deserve a place in the pantheon?
I love the King of Clubs album. It's hard to find out there in the world. My mother had re-released them in the 90s, and they're out of print again. And there's another album that I just think, to me, it just epitomizes kind of what my father did. It's called Primogeneration 72. And my father in the late 60s incorporated one of the greatest Hammond B3 players in the world, Richie Barola, Little Richie, and went more into a rock and roll direction. And there's some songs on this album that just blow me away. It's a really solid studio album, and it just, for me, it speaks to the diversity of my father. Because if you go pick up, you know, you could take something from the 30s, you could take something from the big band area, you could take something from the 50s, you know, early Vegas and Keeley, you could take something from my mom, and then you can take Primogeneration 72, and they're all just brilliant musically, but completely different. They're technically completely different styles, but it's all Prima.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's all Prima. I think that's
it's all Prima.
It's all Prima, baby. I think that's I think that's a perfect place to end it. But thank you so much for your time today. I've really.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Absolutely.
No, it's really great, and I hope we can maybe introduce some people if they weren't aware of your father's music, they can find it, or maybe can rediscover it and maybe dig a little bit deeper, like we've talked about those other albums and things. If people want to look you up, what's the best way? Where are you online? And if they want to find your band?
Yeah, it's LewisPrimaJr.com is the website, and you can find me on Facebook and Instagram and things like that, LewisPrimaJr. I am on Twitter, but I ignore it because I don't like being that political. they all seem so angry on Twitter. I don't get it. But yes. We're out there. We're looking forward to getting back on the road. We're looking forward to continuing the rich legacy that my father left. And we miss doing it. And the world tells me every day that they miss this style of music, and we're looking forward to coming back.
I know. I think we need you, man. Like, it's been tough And I think now more than ever, like with everything going on in the world, not just with this virus, but everything, I mean, you can't beat, you know, the a night out like yours. And I say, I've seen some of your videos as well, you playing these great songs, and you really bring the show as well. So when you stay in touch, and next time you're over, I'll have to come and buy you a beer or something, you know, a bit more better related. So yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. All right, thank you, Louis Premier Jr. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Y'all be good now.
Oh, you got a jump, jiving. Then you really got a jump, jiving.